I'm going to take the liberty as being the presiding over this meeting to I want to change the order of the program because right now we have some presenters that, and I think is having them give their presentation, then we can then continue with our business of the evening. So if our presenters from the Sierra Donor Services could come up front, and we'll start. Oh, you are? Good. Thank you. You anticipated. Okay. As you've gone through the program, we have, you know, the presentation title is Gift of Life. And we have with us this evening three presenters, and if just excuse me a second, I have just lost my place. And No, I'm just finding my space in my braille. Thank you. Deanna Santana, who is the Public Education Coordinator for the Sierra Donor Services. We have the second presenter is Sandy Nelson, who is a Donor Life Ambassador and a kidney and pancreas recipient and the treasurer of the Solano County Council of the Blind. And then there's been a change in presenters. We have with us Kathy Howard, who is the ocular account manager of the Sierra Donor Services. I think this, you're going to find this to be a very interesting, informative presentation about who can be a donor, who can be a recipient, and some information about the cornea transplants. But you're going to hear, too, about organ and tissue transplants. So let's give our panelists a big hand.
Okay. All righty. I want to first thank Sandy Nelson for introducing us to Mr. Lozano and for the opportunity to speak at the California Council for the Blind. We're honored to be here tonight to share information about how everyone has the potential to be a hero through organ and tissue donation and how transplantation may touch your life, as well as information about corneal transplantation and the research being done in that arena. I'm very grateful to be joined by Sandy Nelson, a member of the California Council of the Blind, like Jean said, and also Kathy Howard, who's the ocular account manager with Sierra Donor Services, who's much better looking than Sam Ramos was. So we are all grateful that she's here. Let me start by telling you what Sierra Donor Services is. It's a nonprofit organ, eye, and tissue transplant donor network serving nearly 4 million people in Northern California and Northern Nevada. We're committed to saving and improving lives by connecting one another to organ. Connecting one life to another through donation and transplantation. We support potential donor families in their time of loss, provide care for them through the donation process, and coordinate the recovery of organs and tissues for transplant. We also provide aftercare support to donor families while at the same time working to inspire universal acceptance of donation to ensure every person in need receives the gift of life. Tomorrow at the registration table, there'll be some brochures about what we're talking about tonight, and I also brought some keychains, and everyone thought that the registration table might be a good place to put those. So tomorrow, stop by if you're interested in those. I want to tell you a little bit about how I became involved with Sierra Donor Services. And in order to do that, I have to tell you about my son, Scott. My son, Scott, was a tall, dark, handsome guy. You know, he was a card. He was a courtesy clerk at Raley's, and he was what they called the worst bagger but the best courtesy clerk, because he would pack everybody's groceries, 30-pound bags, carry them out to their car, have them smiling and laughing, and then it'd take the little old ladies four or five trips to carry their groceries in. But nobody ever complained. They would go to the manager and they'd say, he's the best courtesy clerk we have because he doesn't ask us about the weather. He asks us, what did you do with your grandkids last weekend? Did you guys go to church this Sunday? And he made a commitment to get to know all the customers. So when they would change his what check stand he was bagging at, the entire line would move. So that's the kind of kid that my son was. He was a good student. He was in 2011, he was a junior at Union Mine High School up in Placerville. He was a good student. He was incredibly bright, but he wasn't a great student. He told us a story once that he didn't have to do his physics homework. And I said, really, Scott, who doesn't have to do physics homework? And he said, honest, Mom, the teacher told me I don't have to. And so anyways, I never believed him, but he was getting a B in physics, so I couldn't really argue with him. But I found out later that that actually was the case, that Scott was able to do the problems in his head and would just write down the answers. And his teacher came around and would look at his workbook and say, Scott, you got to show your work. You can't just copy the answer from somebody. And he said, Mr. Purdom, I did do the work. It's all in my head. And he said, show me how to do the work. And so Scott rifled down the problem, and he was right. And so they made a deal that he didn't have to do his homework as long as any time Mr. Purdom asked him to show him how he did it, he could. And so Scott ended up with a B in physics without ever cracking a book. You know, he was an all-around great guy. He was an athlete, but he wasn't one of those athletes that didn't like everybody. He wrote a journal that said, I don't belong to any particular clan because if I get kicked out of one, I want to be able to move to another. We learned after Scott's death that when he was a junior, and like I said, he was a starter on the football team for his sophomore and junior year for the varsity team, that there was a freshman girl that was walking around and her backpack was unzipping as she was going to class and books were about to fall out, and Scott ran up behind her and zipped up her backpack and said, you don't want your books to fall all over here because then everybody will make fun of you. Have a great day. And off he went. Well, I never knew that, but I learned about that after his death. And that just kind of is an example to me of the caring, giving heart that Scott had. So on May 17th, 2011, which we're just coming up on 2 years, unfortunately, Scott had a car accident on his way home from school. He wasn't speeding. He was doing 30 miles an hour in a 35-mile-an-hour zone. And unfortunately, he lost control of his car, and there was an SUV coming the other direction. And Scott suffered a traumatic brain injury and also a neck injury. And Scott was dead on scene, but by the grace of God, the paramedics revived him. And because he was a young, healthy athlete, his heart began to beat again. They rushed him to the hospital. They began medical procedures. And for 4 days, the hospital staff, the emergency staff, the nursing staff fought to save Scott's life. They did everything humanly possible to save life. And people around the world were praying for Scott as prayer chains go off. And I'm sure many of you are familiar with those. And we prayed for a miracle. And we got a miracle on May 21st, 2011. It just wasn't the miracle we expected. And our family likes to say, on the worst day of our lives, five families got the best news of their lives. Because Scott became an organ donor and a tissue donor and a cornea donor. Scott's heart... Thank you, but it's all Scott. Scott's heart beats on in a 67-year-old grandpa who's now able to go camping and fishing. His lungs were transplanted into a 26-year-old young lady who had cystic fibrosis and only had dreamed about being able to fulfill her dreams of having a career after college. His kidney and pancreas, one kidney and pancreas went to a mom of three who has diabetes. His other kidney went to a dad who has twins, and his liver went to a 46-year-old dad of three boys. His sight he gave sight to two people, a 14-year-old young man and a 26-year-old young lady. And I love the fact to think that Scott's giving vision to other people because Scott loved the world. He didn't want to be in the United States, not for 1 minute. He went to Australia when he was 12 and found rugby, and from that point on, he only wanted to be on the other side of the pond. So I hope that Scott's eyes are somewhere looking at something other than the United States, because he didn't like it here. A lot of people wonder why I want to go out day after day and talk about Scott and talk about death and talk about grief. And the reason why I do this is I became, as part of my grief program, involved as a Donate Life ambassador because I wanted to look at the best thing that came out of the worst thing in my life and how could I make that a positive situation. Well, when I became an ambassador, I learned that there are over 117,000 people in the United States waiting for a life-saving transplant. There's over 22,000 people in California alone waiting for a transplant, and 18 people die every day waiting for that transplant. And I thought that was a tragedy, because the main reason that people don't donate their organs and tissues is because they either don't understand the process or they have a misconception that they've learned about it. A lot of people rule themselves out because they think they're too old or they have a medical liability, that disability that might prevent them from being a donor. But I can tell you that there's very few things that rule you out from being a donor. We make the recommendation for you to join the registry, which you can do at donatelifecalifornia.org, or you can do it at the DMV when you get your driver's license or ID card. Make your wishes known. The process takes place so that nothing would be recovered if it's not likely to be transplanted. So please, you know, if giving the gift of life is something that you think that you want to do, then make sure that pink dot is on your driver's license. Another thing that we battle in the community is that people think it's against their religion. But there's only two religions, and neither one is largely represented in California, that prohibit donation. And a lot of people are afraid that they won't be saved. And that's the reason why I tell Scott's story, is because I can tell you that they will not even look in your wallet to find out if you have a pink dot on your driver's license. It only happens in a very small number of cases that you're able to be a full donor. But make sure that your wishes are known, not just to when you register, but also to your family. But I can also tell you that your family won't remember a conversation that you had. So please make sure you do both talk to your family and put that dot on your driver's license. I'm going to turn it over to Sandy Nelson, who's going to tell you a little different part about the organ donation and transplantation story.
Hi, guys. You'll have to bear with me. I'm really nervous. You guys know my name. It's Sandy Nelson, and welcome. I'm a kidney pancreas transplant recipient. After almost 40 years of being a type 1 juvenile onset diabetic, my life was forever changed. On November 18, 2005, by two organs, two gifts from someone I didn't even know. I was in the seventh grade, not quite 11 years old, when I had the usual checkup at the doctor. I had all the normal childhood diseases back then of measles, chickenpox, mumps, colds, flu, and most recently, the flu. You know, that flu that got us all back in the late 60s, the influenza outbreak, if any of you can remember. Everybody got it. I just never seemed to get over it. The fatigue, the stomach aches continued off and on for quite some time. And by October, I was beginning to have these constant feelings and stomach feelings and constant cravings. I was hungry, but I didn't feel good. I was eating my mom at a house and home. We went back to the doctor, and he gave us he took some more blood work and told us that, yes, it was a virus, that I'd had a virus in the past. This continued until February in 1968, after my parents became really concerned, because now not only had I been feeling poorly, I had also dropped weight. Again, I went to the physician, and they put me on the scale. I was 5'2" and 68 pounds. I had lost 38 pounds since my first measurement in September. Remarkably, I was still keeping on going, but I knew that I was really sick. My doctor came back into the room. His face was very pale, and he told my parents that Sandy has diabetes. At that moment, all I heard were the words, "Die." We were transferred to another doctor who had specialized in diabetes, especially with children. He perked me up on the exam table, told me, "Don't worry, Sandy, we're going to take care of you." I went home to pack my little suitcase, not knowing if I would be coming back, and I went to Good Samaritan Hospital. There I spent 10 days learning how to give myself injections, learning what to eat, what not to eat, learning I had to eat at certain times because of my insulin injections and peaks that I would have to have food in my system. I learned that exercise would keep me in control and also live a more normal life. And I could live a happy and normal life with control. I must say, my life was all changed with that diagnosis, but I swore to myself that I would do everything I could to keep from ever feeling like that again. I just followed my way. I followed my diet. I exercised. I was very active in school. I competed in junior high, high school, and college. And my last competition, I won second place in the Northern California gymnastic. I went on to college. I got my Bachelor of Science degree in nursing, and I met my husband there in the aeronautical engineering program. We were married in 1985. I loved my work, and I specialized in pediatric oncology and hematology. I loved my job, but I couldn't say no very easily. Nurses are always asked to work double shifts, as well as nurse's aides. They're always short on staff. Saying no was hard for me. So that led to lots of overtime. But, you know, I always thought I could catch up on sleep, like we all do. As I grew older, I noticed that things like stress, lack of sleep, and almost everything affected my blood sugar. I continued to work, and I soon found that reactions were happening quite frequently for myself. No matter what I did, I couldn't get under control, and that was not normal for me. I would go to the doctor, and we'd set up some other routine to do. I continued working until I had several very low unconscious reactions. It devastated me. This was not supposed to happen. This was not what I envisioned. When I could no longer work, I stayed at home and tried to figure out what in the heck I could do to be productive with what I could do. I became what I read in medical books of all the complications that could arise from diabetes, and that was not in my dreams. Soon, I was diagnosed with cataracts, had those removed, and then had glaucoma in my left eye where I had a drain surgically placed, and that decreased my pressure. And then the retinopathy was discovered, and I had multiple laser treatments, and I was declared legally blind. I then decided that, you know what, I can still do a lot of things. Maybe I'll become a floral designer because I see enough to get in trouble, but I sure could put some flowers together. As time went on, I began noticing other symptoms, and I was diagnosed with end-stage renal disease. I soon started dialysis in December of 2004. And I was put on the transplant list. for a kidney and pancreas transplant. I was hopeful, but there are a lot of people on the transplant list, and I wasn't sure at that point that I could make it in time. Things were rough. I pretended they weren't, but deep inside I knew they were. We were getting ready to move to Washington State, where my husband had a job transfer. I set up my dialysis appointments in Washington, and I was ready to go in 2 weeks. It was during the Thanksgiving weekend of 2005. My brother called and asked if I would like to go to the Harry Potter premiere with my nephew. Boy, that was big time, and he really wanted to go. He was so excited. So I could spend the weekend with them, and I went. I brought my phone because, you know, I'm on call for that call. And we got into the theater, and wouldn't you know it, lights went out, phone rang. I was so excited, I almost screamed and shushed by everybody in the theater. We walked out, and I was on my way to California Pacific Medical Center. I had to be there by midnight, just like Cinderella. And I arrived, my family was there, my good friends were there, and my best friend from nursing school had a bottle of Dom Perignon, and she said, "This is waiting for you when you come out." I entered the operating room, and I noticed that there were two doctors sitting in the corner working quickly on something I didn't know what it was. I wasn't put out at that time, but they were making sure and cutting necessary tissue for my organs so that they could be placed nice and cleanly. When I woke up, I have to tell you guys, I didn't have any pain. I don't remember any pain. Of course, we're on the pump when you come out of surgery, but I didn't ask for any pain medicine. They kept asking me, are you all right? And I said, oh my gosh, I've never felt so good in all my life. My cheeks were flushed and red and rosy. My color returned. I didn't have a complication with recovery. I got to go home in almost a record 7 days. I missed Thanksgiving. That pumpkin pie at the hospital just doesn't taste right. But from that moment on, I can eat whatever I want at any time I want. And I am just free of the worry of going to bed and not waking up. I have to tell you guys also that during the time of all this upheaval for myself, we decided to get a dog, another dog. And she turned out to be, of all things, my care dog. She's a Rottie. We love Rots. And when I was having a low reaction, she, at 8 weeks old, started crying. And she started pawing at my foot. Now, I was unable to recognize when low reactions occurred later on in my life with diabetes. So they would pop up and I could fall right over anywhere. She would alert me. I could figure out, hey, something's wrong, and go get myself to prevent an unconscious low. So she saved my life so many times. But today, because of my transplant, because of that special gift, she is off duty, and she's the princess she deserves to be. What I can tell you now is that, like Deanna had mentioned, all of us can give the gift of life, and that gift is a special gift. My donor's name, I soon found out 5 years later, his name was Darren. He was 16 years old, a very active kid in high school, and he and his best friend were on an ATV going around in the field. They lived on a farm. They had an accident. Darren had suffered a massive head injury, and his family decided that they were going to donate Darren's organs. It was difficult for them, but they decided he would want that. So now I have his kidney and his pancreas, and I can live a normal life. And I wake up every morning thanking Darren, most of all, his family, and All of us can do that. So please know that you can help save or help change someone's life for the better. Thank you.
So now I'm going to talk a little bit about cornea blindness and cornea transplantation. Our eye bank was started in the 70s by Northern California Lions Sight Association and the UC Davis Medical Center. We are now part of a larger organization that's a nonprofit donor network that we coordinate the recovery of eye tissue, organs, and also musculoskeletal tissue and skin for transplantation. At Sierra Donor Services Eye Bank, we provide corneas for transplant, but we also provide eye tissue for practice and research. Our commitment is to our local community so that we're able to consistently provide high-quality ocular tissue, ensuring that every person in need of a cornea transplant receives the gift of sight. So when we get consent for eye tissue, we recover the tissue from two-year-olds to 75-year-olds. We put that tissue in preservation medium and inside a cornea vial. And Deanna is going to pass that around so that you can become familiar with how the tissue is offered out for transplantation to the surgeon. It's put in that vial in preservation medium and stored at 2 degrees to 6 degrees centigrade until the tissue is offered out for transplantation. We evaluate the donor's medical and social history to ensure that the tissue is safe for transplant. And there are many conditions that the patient may have and still not rule them out as a donor. For example, many of you may say, I'm blind. Why would you want my eye tissue? Well, we do. People that have retinal blindness or posterior chamber blindness, their cornea still may be very healthy and viable for transplantation. So we ask that you not rule yourself out, but please, if you want to be a donor, sign up on the registry. You can go to www.donatelifecalifornia.org and sign up to be an organ donor. Also, there are many conditions at the time of patient's death. People die from all kinds of reasons that are either trauma or sicknesses, but you can be quite ill and still become a cornea donor and an organ donor and a tissue donor. Cornea donors can come from people that are the sickest. For example, if you had organ cancer, cancer of the bowel, cancer of the colon, cancer of the breast, thyroid cancer, that rules you out for any kind of tissue donation or organ donation, but it doesn't rule you out as a potential eye donor. So we don't want people to say, rule themselves out. We ask that you sign up as a donor and let the experts decide at your time of death whether or not you are eligible to become a donor. The criteria is very complicated, and if you have any questions about whether you think you could or couldn't be a donor, please, I'll be available for questions after the talk. So when we go on site, we generally recover just the cornea. If we have consent, then we recover the rest of the eye, which is called the posterior pole. From the posterior pole, we take the sclera, which is the white part of the eye. It's used for other kinds of transplants. For example, you had just talked about your glaucoma shunt. Sclera is used to also cover the glaucoma shunt so that doesn't puncture the eye tissue. So the most important thing when we do go out and do a cornea recovery is to get that corneal tissue in preservation medium as quickly as possible. So we like to, our criteria is to have that cornea tissue in the preservation fluid within 15 hours after the time of death. So you can imagine that's a lot of work to actually get the call or the referral of the deceased person, do the review of the case, determine if the patient may be eligible, then go on the donor registry to see if the patient is located on the registry as a first person consent or for us to call the family and approach them about donation, get the consent, do the medical social screening, come back to the laboratory, get all of our equipment, get out to the hospital, do the donor prep and recover that tissue and get that tissue in preservation medium within 15 hours. That's a lot of work. So it makes it easier for us if you go and sign up to be a donor so that your family already knows and that you're already on there as a first person consent. So that's what we would really encourage you to do. So after we do the recovery, we bring the cornea back to the lab and then start work to both evaluate the patient's medical chart, the social history taken from the next of kin, and we also send out a specimen of the donor's blood for laboratory testing to rule out infectious diseases. After all the tests and evaluations are done, we send everything through again to our quality department to process a quality assurance review. And then finally, the two and the history go to our medical director to do a final sign-off for transplantation. At that point, the tissue is then offered out for transplantation. So I think everyone knows what the cornea is, but basically the cornea is the clear dome-shaped covering over your eye. It's really about the size of a dime, the thickness and the size of a dime, or also a contact lens if you're familiar with contact lenses. And the cornea is made of highly organized cells and proteins, but contains no blood vessels. It's really avascular. So there are five layers of the cornea, each having a vital, important function. To see well, all of those layers of the cornea must be free of any clay or opaque area because the cornea must remain transparent to reflect the light properly. So the innermost layer of the cornea is called the endothelium. Each of us is born with a certain number of cells in our endothelium, and as we age, those cells decrease. That's why we have the upper age limit of 75, because after age 75, generally those cells are very depleted. Now, I can tell you, occasionally there are 75-year-olds that have excellent-looking corneas, but for the general reason, we just cut off at 75. So when the clear covering or the cornea becomes clouded or opaque from many different things, it can be from trauma or infection or disease, eventually it can cause so much scarring that the patient may become corneal blind. So some of the examples that cause this scarring are trauma. The trauma could be punctures or lacerations, foreign bodies or burns. And the infections could come from viral, bacterial, or fungal. And some examples are herpes. Herpes of the eye is very, very common and is the most common reason for corneal blindness. There are other diseases that affect the eye and the cornea also. One of them is Fuchs dystrophy. That's a major cause of corneal blindness. And it's a condition that affects the innermost layer that destroys the cells that cause a chain reaction to the rest of the cornea, making it swell and become opaque or clouded. The cell loss is then irreversible because I told you there's only so many cells that you have in that layer. And so once those become damaged, you have no way of ever recovering from that. The only possible way is a cornea transplant. So there are different techniques of cornea transplants. For the last 70 years, there's just been mainly one technique, and it's been performed to 90% success rate. It's considered the most successful transplant of all transplants, and it's called a full-thickness cornea graft or a penetrating keratoplasty. And in a PK, the surgeon cuts out the damaged cornea. They use a little trephine blade that looks like a cookie cutter in a round shape. They remove the entire cornea and then replace it with an allograft or donor cornea. It's sutured in place with a serial around the edge of the cornea. Sutures are placed, and they're left there for a year to a year and a half. And the reason that it takes that long is it takes that long for that cornea to become part of the person's new eyeball, for the donor tissue to actually take. The only problem with PKs is when the doctors suture that cornea down, it may cause the shape of the eyeball to change, which may change the visual acuity because it may cause astigmatism. So you may go in blinded, but have your sight restored only to have glasses because you have astigmatism. So in the 6 years, there's around 2006, a new technology of transplant was developed that focused on transplanting only the affected layers of the cornea. These procedures are called endothelial keratoplasties. I told you about that lower bottom tissue, the endothelial layer. Well, there are various forms of endothelial keratoplasty. They differ with thickness of the grafts transplanted, but ultimately they accomplish the same objective, which is replacing the damaged area of the cornea with healthy donor tissue. Unlike the penetrating keratoplasty, the EK procedures only require two small incisions, the largest being only less than 1/8 of an inch. So you could see if you replace that tissue and only have to have a small amount of suturing, it's not going to change the contour of your eye. So therefore, you won't have the astigmatism issue. So patients that are just having those endothelial transplants do not have the visual acuity problems that PK patients have. The cornea usually clears in 6 to 8 months, which is half the time in a penetrating keratoplasty. And so going back to the Fuchs dystrophy, that's the kind of patient that would really benefit from this endothelial keratoplasty. So those procedures are prepared by bringing the donor cornea into our laboratory, and we cut down into that endothelial layer, making it available for transplants. And just to give you a reference about that tissue, the tissue that is transplanted is about the same thickness as a human hair. So this procedure has grown in popularity and is used as much as the penetrating keratoplasty. So about 50% of the patient have PKs and about 50% have EKs. But this is a very, very new kind of transplant, and it's just starting to take hold. So we believe it's going to really change over the next several years. So the future of transplant is that there are a lot of advancements to improve the transplant technology while reducing the risks and side effects to the recipient. And scientists are actively researching ways to use stem cell therapy to replace the cornea without the need of transplants. Stem cell therapy is also being used to research for eye disease that affects the retina. And we have also provided research tissue for our doctors developing cornea cloning. So that's why it's imperative for our bank to continue to receive transplantable tissue as well as tissue for research so that we can help prevent blindness in the future. So does anyone have any questions?
Thank you. Before we have the audience, I have one question to ask you, Ms. Howard. I work at Sac State in the Disabled Student Services office, and one of my students recently came in who's maybe going through some experimental cornea transplant, and the doctor and him had been talking about a transplant from the tissue from a shark's eye. Do you know anything about that?
No, I don't. I don't. In fact, we work very closely with UC Davis Medical Center. So if this is going on at another facility, you know, I might not know about that. But since we're affiliated with UCD and that's the center for research that I know about in Sacramento, it'd be very interesting to find out about that.
Because apparently, for some reason or other, there's a particular type of shark, which I don't know what it is, that it's cornea tissue. It's supposed to be supposed to be excellent for this, and I was just wondering, that's something he and his doctor have been looking at.
Yeah, so. Well, what's interesting to us is that there actually is a lot of human corneal tissue available. There isn't a shortage. There may be a shortage from 1 week to another, but in general, there is not a real shortage. In fact, a lot of corneas from the U.S. are going outside because the tissue is viable for 14 days in this medium, but doctors are very picky and they only want to use it the first 5 days. So if we have tissue that's not placed in the first 5 days, then it goes overseas to other countries.
Interesting. Okay, questions. We could take probably 5 questions.
Thanks. My question is, you mentioned an age limit on corneal transplants. What about other organ donor transplants? Is there an age limit?
Do you want to answer, or you want me to? Well, generally speaking, we don't put an age criteria out there. We evaluate the patient at the time of their death, because you can get a 16-year-old that has mistreated their body from the time they were very young, and their organs may not be as functioning as well as a 65-year-old or a 70-year-old. So we try to evaluate each organ separately, because someone's pancreas might not be working well, but their kidneys may be working there. Their heart might be very, very strong, but their lungs are not as viable. So every patient is different every time. But generally, we take organs. We evaluate up to age 85. Sure.
I was just wondering, you mentioned stem cell research for certain retina diseases. Do you have the specific diseases that they're
targeting?
You
know what? We don't, because we're only involved in the corneal part. And it's frustrating, because we knew you would ask those questions, because, you know, I'm preaching to a crowd that's really very interested. Unfortunately, we just work with the, you know, anterior portion of the eye.
Is there a cost for the cornea?
Yes, that's an excellent question, because it's free to us, but we provide it out for transplantation, and we charge a fee. In the United States, it's against the law to sell tissue, so we're not selling the tissue. We're actually recovering for the recovery fees, the evaluation fees, and the processing fees, and the distribution fees. Generally, the cost that we, at our bank right now, we're on the lower end across the United States, the charge that we put through to the surgical facility is $2,800 for a cornea. So for a cut cornea, we add on $650 to that. But we're one of the lowest, believe it or not, in California, in an expensive town, we are the lowest in the United States. We try to keep our fees as low as possible.
It was research. And to start with, they weren't that expensive. Now they say the cost is close to $1 million.
Oh, my gosh. You probably got your tissue probably very, very on the low end, because they were experimenting probably. And that's what happens, is that they use patients as experimental, because we really need to, but then when it becomes viable, then the costs go up.
I had a question. You had mentioned cloning. Does that mean actually cloning the cornea to grow individual corneas?
Yes.
That you're getting to?
For example.
I can tell what I thought you were getting at, but I wasn't sure.
No. That's exactly right. What the doctors are doing are taking tissue from the patient's good cornea. They're putting it in a petri dish, and believe me, it's more scientific than that. But yes, they are cloning a whole cornea for transplant. And that's being done at UC Davis.
Question. Is there any work being done on progress towards an optic nerve implant or clone through stem cell?
Yes,
okay.
That's exactly right. And we have been really trying, we were trying to prepare for this talk because we knew you were going to ask us those questions. Unfortunately, we had a hard time finding out that information also. But yes, there is stem cell therapy for retinal and optic nerves, and they're actually talking about optic nerve transplants now. That's going to be super, super important. Because those nerve cells are so tiny. If you talk about the endothelial being the size of a hair, I can't even imagine what those optic nerve cells are like. And that's what has been the bugaboo about everything, is trying to get those nerves reconnected. Thank you so much for this opportunity.
And if you do have a few minutes where maybe if people have questions, could you maybe speak with them outside of the room? And maybe a few minutes, unless your schedule prohibits that. I'm talking a very short period of time. So, Okay. Again, thank you very much. Okay. Credentials committee. Oh, let's, before that, door prize. Katrina Fudge. Somebody's going to draw the number?
Yeah.
Okay. Eugene Lozano.
Oh.
Debbie Berry.
One more.
Okay, we'll do one more. Yeah. Oh, unfair.
Martin Jones.
Martin Jones. Okay.